Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Pollyannas, how's it going? Can you hear me?
I'm good. Can you hear me?
I can indeed. Perfect.
I went through about 5 sets of headphones here to make sure I found one that was working, so we're all good. I'm really good. It's a sunny day in Wicklow. I'm out planting some seed potatoes, and there was a nice frost this morning. There's frog spawn all over the place, and it's very, very springy.
Wow.
Very springy.
So, newts. So, in this episode, we are talking about something a little bit different. Can you tell me what we're talking about?
Yeah, so we're talking about a new arrival to Ireland, and it's the Alpine newt. And we're talking about some of the research a colleague of mine, Aine, is doing into them, how they might or may not affect the habitat that they encroach on, and how they may or may not affect native wildlife, all those good things.
And we're meeting your colleague, Aine, in a very special place. Can you describe where we're meeting?
I invited you down to the Frog and Toad for a wee chat. But we were very good. We stayed reasonably sober. So, yeah.
But what is the Frog and Toad?
The Frog and Toad is a bar I built in my shed because there's no local pubs up here. So I needed somewhere to go just to have a wind down at the end of the day. So yeah, it's and aptly named for the area it's in anyway, surrounded by ponds.
I have to say the Frog and Toad is truly extraordinary. It's a garden shed but from the outside, but when you walk into it, it's an old-fashioned pub and it's fabulous. And you made all of the stuff yourself, didn't you? Like, it's absolutely stunning.
Yeah, I made it from recycled materials. All the walls and the bar itself and everything is all made from pallets and bits of wood and bits of junk I found. And yeah, it's a passion project, but it's very cool now.
It's the coziest country pub that you've ever seen, except you'll get 3 people into it. It's amazing. So I hope everybody enjoys the episode. It's a fairly interesting episode. It's also, I think, a pretty important one. And it's lovely to meet Aine as well. So we hope you enjoy the episode.
Yeah, I think Aine is a top young science communicator, up and coming scientist. And I think it's a very interesting episode, not just particularly about this species we're talking about, but about invasives in general, or introduced species in general, and what they can get up to. Now, right, I got my little nicotine, so I don't have
to
go.
Very, very good.
So we're in the Frog and Toad.
Yeah.
And we are here with, who are you?
My name is Aine O'Cossack.
What are you doing here?
Well, I'm here to talk about newts, alpine newts. We're here to talk about the guys that are sitting in front of us on this table that obviously your audience can't see. Yeah.
So we're sitting in the tiny Frog and Toad pub, and in front of us on the tiny table is a container with newts. But they're different. They're special newts. And you have a story about the first day that you met these.
Yeah, so I suppose we better start 7 years ago. Aine was in college in TCD, so we would have met there, become friends over the years. And you'd been out a couple of times with me doing field work and sampling on our native newts.
I had my eye in, as Collie would say, on what the smooth newt might look like.
Yes.
And lo and behold, we see this newt when I work as an ecologist. And we found these newts. I was like, there's something a bit strange going on here. There's something weird afoot. So I messaged Collie.
Yeah, and I was driving on the Frogmobile at the time. And I was at traffic lights and I just pulled up the picture. I was like, oh, what's that? And I saw straight away, I was like, where the fuck did you find that? And I just kind of was excited to see it, because you're always excited to see something weird. And I just assumed it was in a local housing estate or somewhere you were doing some work in, but
it turns out it was in bang in the middle of the countryside, right, on a bog that was at least 10 kilometres away from any of the villages or any big town that might be able to facilitate the transport of newts, because obviously you'd need maybe a garden centre that would have newts being sold there, or maybe even pet trade or something like that. That didn't exist in the area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so but what are they?
Well, yeah, to me, I'm looking at these newts and they look like newts.
Yeah. Mm.
But they're not our native newt.
No, so to the trained eye, you can see that these guys are slightly different. They're a tiny bit bigger. But also, if you flip them over, as I like to do, you'll see that they have...
Holly's reaching in now.
A completely got one there. Unspotted belly.
A totally orange belly with no spots. And that to you meant...
That it was weird, for lack of a better term. It was definitely different, because the smooth newts have spotted bellies, right, both males and females.
So this is not a native species. And what is then
the name of it?
Yeah.
So the name of it is the alpine newt, Ichthyosaur alpestris, or as I've called it now in Irish, Antarc Shleva.
Did you coin that in Irish?
Yeah, I did.
Great.
It has to be used.
Yeah, fantastic.
It's a continental European species, and it's known as an invader in a lot of different areas because they're incredibly beautiful as you look at them.
They are.
And people noticed that and were like, my God, there might be a pound to be found in this. So since the 1920s, they've been introduced over to the UK, and they have made it into New Zealand. They've also been introduced into different areas in Poland, where they are in Poland generally native, but... It's not across the entire country that their distribution is. In areas where it's not native, there are serious concerns when they do find them. Mm. And they found them in Spain as well, and they found them in France. Even though they are native to both France and Spain, they found them outside of their regions, and that big concerns for conservationists.
So why are you worried then that they're here? What do they do?
In terms of what the big problem is that they could potentially spread a disease called chytridiomycosis. And chytridiomycosis is a disease that was first identified in around 1995. And as a result of that, we use bleach on everything that we use, because...
We have some beer to wash our hands afterwards, yep.
And it's so vitally important, because over 40% of amphibian populations across the entire world are in decline as a result or implicated with chytridiomycosis.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
And if you're looking to find out about chytrid and what it does, you can throw back to a brilliant episode of The Critter Shed with Rob Gandola, who's also working on this project with his our mate Rob in the HSI. So,
that's the Herpetological Society of Ireland.
Yeah, the herpes crowd. but, yeah.
What do I need to know about these guys?
So what you need to know is that they could potentially spread a disease called chytrid.
Yeah.
But secondly, as well, they could compete with our native newt populations. They could also predate on our native newt and frog populations. Mm-hmm. But more than that, too, they actually have a toxin called tetrodotoxin. Mm-hmm. It's actually produced by bacteria that live on their skin.
All right.
Now, our concerns is that this neurotoxin, which actually inhibits, it stops the protein or the sodium pumps between your neurons. It causes your nervous system to shut down.
Really?
Yeah, because your neurons use sodium to transmit messages. If they can't do that, it's done. It won't work anymore. But we're concerned about what if an Irish native species went off, say, a badger and ate 200 of these? What impact would that have? Or... arguably, what if this one particular buzzard, say, was really into killing kingfishers, who was very into killing these guys? We'd start talking about bioaccumulation effects, where these toxins start building up in populations, and we simply have no idea what tetrodotoxin would do to our native species, because it doesn't exist here.
Yeah, and it's an interesting one, kind of similar to our toad situation up in the Dublin Hills, where we have a large population of introduced common toads. We're quite anglicised in Ireland. The Wind in the Willows, you know, Ratty Mole and Mr. Toad, and people just assumed that the toads were just part of the fauna. And I think with, you know, alpines are kind of considered an introduced species. They're borderline introduced slash invasive in the UK.
Yes, they're still doing research on it, yeah. But it looks at least that all of the research that they're doing is how are these guys invasive? That's kind of the research that we are looking to do too.
Can I ask a question then?
Yeah, of course.
What is the difference between invasive and introduced?
Okay, so it's actually quite easy to explain when you break down to the core concepts of it. You have non-native species. Non-native species are species that have been moved from one place to the other. And that's easy.
The hedgehog in Ireland.
Yeah, there you go.
Or it's non-native.
No, it's non-native, yeah.
No, my jaw just dropped.
Yeah. Now, the rabbit too, there's another example, but the rabbit is invasive because it's not only competing with our native hare, but also it reduces biodiversity. And that's the big kicker. If you have a non-native species that's introduced into a new ecosystem and it reduces the population, it's almost by definition, according to science, an invasive species. But not everybody runs off the scientific book when it comes to invasives or invasiveness in general. It's defined by policy at the end of the day. And policy lags behind science as science leads the way forward. And we're still trying to figure out, even on a European basis, what to do with these guys because they're native in Europe. They are invasive in areas and they do spread disease.
Okay.
So it's not only an Irish problem, it's a UK problem, it's also a European problem.
So these guys you found in a bog and they're invasive, which means they're bringing a lot of issues with them and they're bringing this disease with them as well as their toxin. So what do you do then in that situation?
Well, this is where we are at the moment. It's they're brand new to the island. And while I'm speaking about Ireland as an island, that is a very important factor here. We've been separated from Europe for hundreds of thousands of years. And the fauna that's here has also been separated. And we don't know the effect that these guys are going to have on our native amphibians. Aside from the threat of diseases, which we have to screen for, we have to go through everything. We don't know the effect or if they have parasites or anything that they could be bringing in. Another factor is on the continent, they have grass snakes, they have great crested newts, they have all sorts of different reptiles and other amphibians that predate specifically on these guys that have evolved beside them to eat them. We don't have them. So what are we going to do here? Is it going to be the old woman who swallowed the fly and just keep putting in new animals? You can't do that because that's not ethical or smart. So it's a complicated issue and it really warrants a serious, serious approach. If it was a mammal, I would say there'd be a lot more fuss being made about it at the moment. But because they're the slimy little newt creatures, they've kind of gone under the radar. Again, it's only a couple of years we know they're here, but it really does warrant serious scientific investigation and you know, just to see what's going on and what the effects are and how they're getting here.
Yeah, and I mean, like, there's nothing wrong with being able to say, we actually don't know.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of Socratic method in this is imperative because we have to turn around at the end of the day and say, we have no idea yet. Yet being the very important word here because we want to look into this. They got here likely as a result of humans. And obviously they're just animals and
not their fault.
It's not their fault, but realistically speaking, not only do we have to look at how they got in order to be able to mitigate that happening again, but also how do we contain it and how do we remove these threats? Because, for example, the smooth newt is doing terribly in Ireland. 50% of the ponds in Ireland have been wiped out and they need those ponds
really?
To be able, yeah, like 50% of agricultural ponds in the last 50 years have been wiped out, mainly as a result of us moving towards more intensive agriculture. But that knock-on effect is that these guys have no beds to listen to Barry White in. That's not good.
That's it. That's exactly it. You put a species like the smooth newt under pressure. You introduce something that's bigger, hungrier, and could potentially have a snack on the few smooth newt tadpoles and efts that are emerging. And you're looking at trouble. And, you know, preliminary reports from the UK and anecdotal reports from people that I know who who have worked on sites in the UK have noticed that when the Alpines move in, the smoothies tend to drop in number, which is completely understandable.
And which is also interesting from our perspective too, considering we've not found that. Mm. We've essentially not found a single smooth newt on any of the sites where we found Alpine newts. And that raises concerns, because what if we have already lost local extinctions of smooth newts in these areas? We just didn't know because we weren't looking. Mm. That is one of the real concerns on my part, because in Ireland, the smooth newt's doing incredibly poor, but over in Australia, for example, in Melbourne, it's invasive. Mm. These guys are declining on the continent.
These guys being the
Alpine newts, mm. Yes. They're declining on the continent in populations, but when they get over here, it's
exploding.
Yeah.
The common toad in the UK around many of the areas that would have been very common is going down in number. Mm. In Dublin, it seems to be increasing in number. It's the dynamics of them is very interesting from a geeky scientific point of view. It's fascinating.
But it leads you to just kind of sit there and start spitballing in ways of, how is this? What have we...
That's what I was going to ask.
Yeah.
How do they make numbers of our native newts drop?
Well, A, via competition. Mm. Obviously, less prey resources would allow you to have less children in the long run. But also, we haven't found chytrid yet in our preliminary screenings, but that's only from 1 year, mm. You know, and we're going to be doing this till, geez, the cows come home.
Mm. Yeah.
That's the only way we'll guarantee that chytrid isn't coming into the country.
Sorry, remind me where these guys are actually native to. So they're called Alpine.
Yes, and it actually is a bit misleading, considering you'd be able to find them not only in mountainous areas, but also valleys across continental Europe.
Yeah.
You can find them. There's one population in northern Spain, mm-hmm. as far as I'm aware.
Yeah.
And then they go unbroken from southeast France all the ways over to the Russian steppe, which is a huge, area to cover. And they have 7 subspecies of Alpine newts.
Now, as we're looking at them here, they're in this container in front of us. They are incredibly beautiful.
Yeah.
They look like large tadpoles sort of with legs and thicker bodies. They're just very beautiful.
And if you look at it, you can see the dimorphism between the males and the females. Dimorphism means sexual dimorphism, and that means that the males and the females don't look the same. Think of it.
You and I are sexually dimorphic.
Yes, we are. We are. Thank God for you. But think of a rooster and a hen. You know, you'd be able to tell one from the other. And it's the same with this species. You can see the male that are smaller here. Mm. They've got a nice fan tail. They haven't got that crest that our native little water dragons have, the smooth newts. But they do have very bright colours. For displaying for the females, and they have the large ball bag, for want of a better word, between the legs at the back, and that's where
no
they'll
scientific term.
But that's where they'll deposit their sperm packets, and the females will collect the sperm packets internally and fertilise. Another reason they can compete as well against the native species is because they tend to spend a lot more of their time in the water, and they go back to the water earlier than our ones, so they've got a head start.
Yeah, so they're physically taking up the space.
Yeah.
Yes. In a huge amount of different ways, because say if they were competing with smooth newts, if they were able to outcompete them, that's an issue. If they were eating, say, frog spawn, which is one of the things that our smooth newts love, they'd go absolutely berserk for that kind of stuff. These guys would be there before them, obviously, because the frogs will lay the eggs in the pond, and the lads will arrive down first, and the smooth newts will arrive down, and it's not feast or famine, it's just straight up famine for them.
It's like people going down early to put their towels on the best
places
on the beach.
Like all the Europeans.
Yeah, maybe that's it now.
Maybe
that's it.
Here's an interesting thing. I'm going to take this. So I put in some pond weed with them earlier on. Earlier on, as in yesterday evening. And if you look at that, you can see a lot of little gelatin balls here.
Ah.
So they are.
They've laid eggs.
They've laid eggs.
Whoa.
And you can see on that one there, there's probably 30 eggs on it.
Yeah.
In a day.
So that's only the length of your arm.
Yeah. So they are prolific.
Yeah.
Prolific layers of eggs.
So I'm going to tell you now what I learned from our other podcast about newts. So I learned that the newts sort of lay individual eggs, and then they'll wrap the eggs in leaves. And is the same thing happening
same
with these
guys? Same thing here. You can see some of them are wrapped, but sometimes they just throw them out all over the place.
Okay.
There's a lot of wrapped ones here, and then there's some just free on the branch. But the females of these species are bigger, so will be able to lay bigger and more eggs.
Right.
So Yeah, there's a number of competitory factors involved in them getting here. It's a whirlwind, really, that they're here. I'm not going to lie, it's very exciting from a nerdy scientific point of view, but it is also concerning from that same point of view as well. And there's all sorts of ethics involved in these kind of questions that we'll have to really seriously look into. They're obviously established here in the country. Whether we could get rid of them even is a question we're going to have to answer. New Zealand, they're struggling to do it. They get rid of them and then a population appears somewhere else because they're so prolific. Yeah. They'll just start off again. And again, you could not notice them for years. Yeah. And then they just...
Well, especially considering how different our lives are to theirs in ways. They head off for all of winter and you'd only see them at night, more than likely, because they're very... crepuscular forward slash they love going out at night.
There's one there just up against the glass now, and you see that amazing orange underbelly.
Yeah,
it's incredible. You've just lifted it out now and beautiful.
Yeah. Gorgeous.
Oh,
somebody had a chunk out of her leg there as well, you can see, but growing back. Very tough little creatures.
Yeah.
I won't eat a sandwich after handling her though.
Yeah.
But amazing to think how they've set up so well here. Interesting as well and worrying down the line is, here's another one. So you have in mainland Europe, we have a very beautiful salamander called the fire salamander, which has unfortunately gotten infected with chytrid in Holland and Germany and places to the extent that massive populations are completely on the verge of collapse. They've had to take away breeding adults that are healthy to kind of keep them as in an arc, basically, to ensure that they can put them back once we've kind of established how to deal with a chytrid outbreak. Now, they're also in pet trades. They also breed around places that would have aquatic centres that would breed plants that would be shipped around the world. If an animal like that that's on the verge of extinction ends up in Ireland, doing well in Ireland, what do you do then? You know what I mean? Which could happen, you know, could happen down the line, could already be going on. There could be another species of newt here. There could be grey crested newts here historically because they used to sell them in pet shops. I remember grey crested newts when I was a kid were regularly sold in a pet shop in Crumlin in Dublin.
Wow.
Like that's that, and that'd be unheard of now. That's 40 odd years ago, you know what I mean? But it's opening up a Pandora's box, for want of a better word, but it really is fascinating. And again, we've a lot to answer for as people that ship them around and move plants and move containers that might have these creatures in them.
But also fog in the middle of nowhere, like,
yes,
but this is the thing. So like you can't the first thing everybody was saying, like a pet trade, and it's like not many people, you know what I mean, have exotic pets in a bog in the middle of nowhere. Obviously we can't give away too much details because it's still
roughly the middle of nowhere.
The middle of nowhere is like far away from civilization.
And we've also found them in tree middles of nowhere at this point.
Exactly, yeah. We're finding them everywhere and they're well established everywhere. And it's like, how do they arrive in these places is the first question to be answered. And then after that, then it's kind of like, as we were saying, what do we do?
Well, that's the human aspect of it as well, Collie. And I think understanding the socio aspect of this is incredibly important. And one of the ways that I think is a really good example of this is actually during World War One, because all of these exotic plants were moved around in the 19th century and there would have been a huge amount of money. So take your rhododendron, your Himalayan balsam, your Japanese knotweed, the ones that are everywhere now, the ones that you could literally take, step outside the lovely frog and toad now, throw a stone, you'd probably hit one.
Rhododendron just there.
Looks absolutely stunning, but is invasive because...
Well, it produces, I think, over a couple of million seeds every single year.
It essentially pushes everything out.
And it has an expansion range because it spreads via the wind of over 600 kilometres. But as well, the aspect of it that I found fascinating was that when World War One broke out, these plants would have been held inside in really well-to-do gardens from... you know, like Sir Thomas Edward Charles the 14th.
There was a fashion of bringing plants back from travels during the late 1800s, the golden age of science.
But as well, you could make a fortune. If you were to say, I don't know, monopolize rhododendron sales in France. So you're after taking the seeds of rhododendron, you're after bringing it all the ways across to the Eurasian continent, something that was very dangerous to do back then. Mm. You get it home, you try and germinate these seeds. If you manage that, you are a millionaire.
Yeah.
Now, when you put it in the context of what happened in World War One, the gardeners were keeping these guys under control because they were coming along, they were pruning them, and they were getting paid to prune them. And obviously, this would have been an incredibly skillful trade. But the gardeners got sent to war in 1914. And when they came back in 1918, some of them didn't. Some of them didn't come back in the same way that they went out. But the genie was officially out of the bottle because giant hogweed started spreading all over the place. Rhododendron was all over the place. Japanese knotweed was all over the place. And it takes time before people realise what's going on. Mm-hmm. The first time we actually knew what was going on with giant hogweed, it was children coming home with burns all up their arms and burns down their legs because it's a phytotoxic plant. It means that if you get it on your skin and you expose that to sunlight, you're going to get serious burns all up your hands. And picture the poor kids coming home to their parents, not being able to describe this to them.
Yeah.
Now, to me, it's similar because we have an acknowledgement of what we can do. We have far bigger brains than these poor lads. Mm. We can mediate the change now by talking about what we have, what is native and what isn't, and acknowledging and getting our eye in on what actually is native is probably our best defense against non-native species coming in and becoming invasive as a result of that.
That's fascinating about the really interesting about the
crazy stuff. Yeah.
That's really interesting. I never knew that. So yeah, thanks for telling us that. That's really, really cool. It is weird because if you walk up the road here, I was saying to Colette earlier on, if you go for a little stroll up to our, there's a pine forest with a nice strip of native forest beside it. And right now it looks stunning. It looks like something out of Star Trek because you have all these blooms of rhododendron. And everybody around the neighbourhood will talk about it and say how stunning it is at this time of year. And of course, my other cap is on going, it is beautiful, but it's horrendous as well because it's shadowing all the forest floor plants that would, the ferns and the native bluebells and all the stuff that would have been out there. But it really shows the impact that these non-native species can have and the damage they cause. I mean, they overran Killarney National Park.
Yeah.
And some of the fires that were caused there were caused by rhododendron bushes, you know?
Well, as well, one of the things that we can start talking about too is the idea of acknowledging, look, this is a problem, but we need to go out and do something about it, stat. Mm. Now, it gets more complex when you really start thinking about it. For example, the butterfly bush is technically a medium impact invasive species, but it's a really important pollinator plant. But here's the question. Are they just using our pollinators to really take off? There's so many different ways you can look at it.
Is that the Buddleia?
Yeah, Buddleia David. Yeah,
they're everywhere.
Absolutely everywhere.
They're one of those plants that grows out of chimneys in the middle of town.
It's there's one coming out of the Central Bank outside Trinity. It's literally popping right out of the... And like if you have a walk through Galway, you probably see more Buddleia Davidi than people.
Yeah.
You know,
is that the sort of pink coloured stuff you see run out of the cracks?
Yeah, and it kind of looks like a big cone coming out of the top. Yeah,
they are gorgeous, and it's amazing how they can survive on almost nothing.
Yeah,
it's
incredible. And to think, as you were saying, that only less than 100 years ago, people would have been practically looking after that in the greenhouse in a Lord's Manor.
Yeah.
That's amazing to think.
So you're faced with this amazing mystery. How in God's name did the newts that you saw get up into these three out of the way places that you found them in? So you're a detective now. What are you going to be looking at for your PhD?
Well, first of all, we're trying to identify how far they've gotten already. Mm. That would be able to give us an indication as to how long they've been here and what we can do from there. We could go out and be like, right, we're gonna wipe them all out in the morning, which we're not. But we could try, and we'd probably fail because we have no idea what we're dealing with.
Mm.
You know, we also want to see how they're invasive.
Mm.
Because, yeah, we could turn around and say they're a non-native species, but how are they reducing biodiversity?
Mm.
And the other aspect of it as well, for me, is at least being able to identify, is there an ecological release? And what I mean by an ecological release is, have a certain amount of the conditions that would have applied pressure to them on their native environment been removed? And
no grass snakes.
No grass snakes. No
nothing chowing down on them.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the big question.
I'm going to call when my wife leaves for a weekend away and I go mental on the beer, an ecological release. An ecological
release. That could be taken in a few ways.
Yeah. Oh my God, no, I didn't mean that way.
Well,
but yeah.
Ecoli release sounds like you're...
E. coli.
No, it sounds like he's going to put his mind onto the cyberspace and take over the world. No,
he's going to dampen it down with alcohol.
Yeah.
But look, it's fascinating. It's one of these stories that I think in the next couple of years we're going to be getting really stuck into this. And I think it's going to be one to watch from a very interesting citizen science point of view, which is we're going to be engaging in that, same as we did with the toads, as in getting people familiar with what these look like. Mm. And more importantly, as Enya said, getting people familiar with what our own native species look like. So if they see something odd, they can go...
Like I did.
Yeah, exactly.
And message someone who might know.
Well, here's me now. So I've only seen newts, smooth newts, a few times. Mm-hmm. I'm not an expert. But looking at those, the one thing that jumps out at me is their underbelly. Is that orange underbelly typical of this particular species?
Yes. Okay. If you were to see that, it's indicative enough. Obviously, a book, a guide would help you along the way. And the other aspects of it, some of the other things that you can use is that the males have a tiny crest that you can see. And they also have spotted flank, which is really, really nice. Mm. They also have two different phases. They have an aquatic phase where they kind of look blue in the water. It's kind of like a bluey-grey colour.
Yes.
But when they're out of the water, as I first found one, they almost have like a marbly, mottly skin. And it almost looks like velvet. Mm. It's very interesting. And as Colly was alluding to earlier on, it's these differences in terms of the timings of what they do. Mm. Because bear in mind, as Colly said as well, like we've been isolated from Europe since the last glacial maximum, like 10,000 years ago. All of these species have lived, evolved, adapted in isolation to all of these species. So while, yes, it is absolutely true that these guys coexist on the continent with our smooth newts in the same way that the white-toothed shrew, and who's our fella?
The pygmy.
The pygmy shrew.
I'm the small lad.
I'm not into mammals.
That's another one. Here we go. Yeah. No, I don't do mammals. Said Colly with a house full of mammals.
Yeah, there's me with my three cats as well. But it's fascinating because, yeah, of course they coexist, but these guys, or our smooth newts, have been isolated, living and evolving by themselves, not in competition with these guys. Now, these guys are hotwired for competition because they've been living and coexisting and even partitioning their niches with these other newt species, which the smooth newt in Ireland has never had to do.
So, yeah, that's a really very important point, and that's it. So these guys are used to scrapping for everything, for every bit of space, whereas our lads have been living the high life on their own.
Yeah.
The smooth newt have been living a very, very luxurious life with no competition for other newt species. So, yeah, that's another one. They're already ready to go in that kind of competition aspect. So, yeah, come here. Look, I just find it all very interesting. It's kind of scary as well, but it's better that we know about that we don't.
Mm. Yeah.
And it brings with it that ever-present issue of ethics. And it's not these animals' fault, as we were chatting about earlier. All of this is caused by humans. And presumably you have to work on a set of ethical guidelines and have that particular conversation about taking out individuals and how you take out individuals, and all that discussion would have to be part of it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think the aspect that is crucial too is that, look, these guys are unfortunate because we've caught them. God bless them. Like, what we want to do is ensure that we don't have to do this anymore, you know? It's fascinating, especially when you start looking at invasive species in general, because in our globalized world, we have reduced the borders and the barriers between over there and here. Yeah. So it doesn't seem too far anymore, especially in the world of planes and boats that bring you around the world and 24 hours.
We don't want to get down the road of we don't want these to be the Irish cane toad. And everybody knows the story with the cane toad and what devastation they caused in Australia. And it's only starting to get under wraps now, and largely down to nature. There's a very good point as well, because, you know, while they've had to help a couple of the native mammals along in great programs, I think we discussed that before on the Critter Shed, where they got possums and fed them liquidized toads to a small degree to make them sick and give them the worst possum hangover ever, and and then let them back out. Another great thing that's happening in Australia is the COVIDs have figured out that if you flip them over, some of the
Corvids
have, yeah, COVID is on my brain, have learned to flip them over and eat them from the underbelly. A couple of the smarter large monitor lizards down there are doing similar things as well. So that's kind of a pushback there. They're also, instead of people being traumatised collecting, well, I don't think the Australians get that too traumatised about killing toads, but they should, they don't seem to care. But a much more ethical way that they're dealing with them now is with, they've discovered that the cane toads, tadpoles, are quite carnivorous. And, you know, they'll eat each other. And if a toad spawns later in the season, the tadpoles that are already there will swim over to the spawn and munch that.
Well, it's fascinating you bring that up, because the green shore crab that we have here is invasive over in the States. And some brilliant marine biologists, they actually are brilliant, they fecked up this one, but they decided to try and eliminate as many of these crabs as they possibly could.
In the States?
In the States, yeah, I believe in California. And when they did this, they went off and they combed the shore for every single one of these crabs that they had, and they put them all in a big bag and they got rid of them. What happened was that these guys are actually cannibalistic. And all of the crab larvae exists in solution. They have to eventually sit down and become crabs themselves. What they did was they wiped out the lads that were keeping them in control. And the population went blew up.
Yeah. So what the Australians are doing with this discovery of the tadpoles eating the later spawn, they've created a synthetic spawn that gives off that smell. They put it in these lobster pots, essentially. The tadpoles from all over the lakes now are crammed in to eat these. They take all the tadpoles out, wipe out a whole generation, and keep doing that, and keep doing that, and keep doing that. So there'll always be cane toads. You're never going to get rid of cane toads. But now they have a natural-ish method of keeping the numbers under wraps. They can turn the toads into fertiliser or into food or something for something else. A really good solution. And, you know,
and God loved the cane toads in the first place, because they were actually brought in to deal with the sugar beetle problem, which was brought in by sugar cane.
Was
which
that the 1950s or what? That's the
1930s.
The 1930s.
Yeah.
So it's taken that long for, first of all, the local animals to work out how to get around the toxin. And second of all, for us to figure out how to mitigate. Yeah.
But also, they, in the time that it took us to figure that out, they conquered an entire continent.
Yeah. So they just stopped short of... is it Perth or Darwin? Darwin.
Did they get that far over? They've
gotten past Darwin. They've gotten into the... since 2007, they're in the Western Australia.
And if you look at some of the research into cane toads, this is going to be a cane toad episode. Yeah. But I mean,
we actually love cane toads.
We have two. Yeah. But the size of them, like, they just kept growing and growing.
Oh, wow.
Huge sizes, because they had, again, the ecological release there, where they had no natural predators. They could eat and eat and eat, and there was so much bugs in Australia that they could just get huge. What is going on with these guys, these alpine newts in Ireland? Are they doing the same thing? Are they bigger than their friends on the continent? We've very lucky in the fact that our friend Rachel from Trinity is over in the UK. Shout out to Rachel. And she's going to be doing her...
PhD
on the same beautiful species. So it's going to be a bit of an Irish takeover on this end of the European.
Yay!
Yes, absolutely.
We're very lucky, because it's going to be a bit of an Irish takeover on this end of the European continent to, you know, to showcase what we know on amphibians. And I'm very excited as well, because it's a new generation of people, especially from Trinity, coming out and getting their paws into this really interesting and really essential research, you know.
Well, so we're sort of breaking news here. This is sort of a new groundbreaking thing.
Yeah,
and
it
we'll
is,
hopefully
yeah.
be hearing from you later.
Oh, well, you can have me back on. Yeah, of course.
Well, what would be nice to do is to go down to one of the sites and show you, because
absolutely.
It is mental when you get down. It's crazy when you see the amount of them, and
especially
it's just
when the cans come out. Like.
that's amateur research, but it's very. We were jostling whether we should go public at all earlier on, but obviously you want to kind of lock it down and get the message out there. So Aine went to a couple of the. It's been national news. Brought up in the Dáil.
In the Dáil.
In the Irish Parliament. So it's getting traction. We just need really now for a lot more of the scientific community to kind of get on board and give us the finances and the support we need to get this.
But as well, we need caution as well with this. And I think caution is probably the focal score that we could leave with this on.
What's focal score mean?
It's like your final word. You yes. know, it's the idea of that this is the thing that people are going to be going home being like, my God, Jesus, wasn't that focal score something? You know, the idea is caution, because if we just take it from a very human perspective of we don't know, we need to look into it. And the best way to be able to look into it safely is with caution than any of these species. And even when we start looking at our lovely alpine newt, one of the best indicators that we can use in science for how potentially invasive this might be is to look at other similar countries. The UK is currently doing the exact same research. New Zealand has branded them as an invasive species, and they're like, geez, it's like Ireland down south, almost in New Zealand.
Obviously, New Zealand will be particularly protective of their fauna after all the disasters that's happening down there. They're almost
the possums and everything.
Tasmanian, all the sorts of stuff that's gone on down there. So it is very wise to be cautious, very wise to be taking this seriously and looking into it and seeing what we can figure out and how to deal with it down the line. And another important factor is getting ordinary people involved so they can help out as well.
And I guess my next question is, whose round is it?
Yeah, it's mine.
Yeah, we absolutely.
Have some blackberry wine.
Get that bell going now.
Time. Brilliant. Thanks for coming, man.
No really worries at all.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.